8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows what's new.
The guy is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
He has been an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for him.
All right, listen up, y'all.
Don't you pay your bills.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough for that.
503 Central, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast, 603 East Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Tuesday morning, Australia. Welcome to the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, this, that, and the other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, located via your favorite internet browser at freedomslips.com. I'm spelling. Broadcasting live from your home location, the state of Minnesota. It is a balmy and humid 75 degrees. The windows are open, so if you hear noise, it's because the windows are open. And there's the creaking of the chair, and one of the cats is sitting next to me on the computer desk, so he might just meow from time to time. I don't believe the forecast either, because apparently last night I checked the forecast, and today was supposed to be a 30% chance of rain and 80. Although we almost reach 80, we had a severe thunderstorm warning and tornado watch up until a few hours ago. So go pound sand, meteorology. Go pound sand. Well, let's get into it, kids, as we always do on the big program.
So again, Bigfoot has been seen.
sand, meteorology. Go pound sand. Well, let's get into it, kid. Dateline, May 8th, 2022. From our friends over at InfinityExplorers.com, Bigfoot are interdimensional creatures. Eyewitnesses state they disappear between worlds using portals. Well, before we get into this, good morning, Pac-Man. Pac-Woman, I'm sorry. 60 Fahrenheit in rain. Flea, I like heat and humidity, so the hotter and more humid it is, it's good. Over the decades of the existence of the Bigfoot phenomenon, it has come a long way from a supposedly unknown large primate to science to something associated with UFOs, telepathy, and even hypnosis. Some eyewitnesses' encounters suggest that Bigfoot are interdimensional creatures. See, what we did there is we converted Bigfoot to plural. So again, it proves my point. Bigfoot, depending on how it's used in a sentence, is either singular or plural. However, some sites will refer to plural Bigfoot as big feets. All right. So the question begs to be asked, are Bigfoot interdimensional creatures? All this indicates that Bigfoot may be creatures that stand apart from the fauna of our planet. In particular, this is claimed by many stories that Yeti can disappear literally before our eyes as if leaving for another dimension or another world. Researcher Sharon Cornett wrote a lengthy article some time ago entitled "The Instant Disappearance of the Yeti, Eyewitness Stories, Implications, and Challenges for Researchers," which focused on cases of Yetis inexplicably, vanishing into thin air. One of the stories she collected tells a typical case when a Yeti disappeared in front of an eyewitness, and another seems to show us that the Yeti go into some kind of portals leading to another dimension or to another world. This story happened in the summer of 2000 when a man named John Bohannon, he claims, he was driving down a dirt road during the daytime west of Three Rivers Campground near Alamo Gordo, New Mexico, when he saw a massive bipedal ape-like creature. It was about 2.5 meters tall and went in the same direction as he was driving. John, as you imagine, slowed down to examine the creature. He saw it, that his whole body was covered with short reddish-brown hair, with longer hair growing under his forearms and face. The face of the creature resembled, according to John, a typical Neanderthal. The creature noticed John, but did not slow down and continued to move on its own. And then, after about 100 feet, it suddenly disappeared, vanished into thin air. It's like he just been somehow erased from this reality, said John. Now, John assures us that there were no trees, stones, pillars, or anything else that could hide the creature's body. Everything looked as if the Yeti entered the, quote, invisible wall, end quote. The story of the portal was received from eyewitness Larry Kelm and took place in August of 1980 near Eugene, Oregon. On this day, Larry decided to go hiking along the old Malala Indian Trail, which connects the ridges of Mount Saddle Blanket in the nearby town of Oak Ridge. The walk went on its own and everything was fine, and then at some point, Larry saw that his surroundings had become somehow blurry, as if cloudy. All the colors had turned gray, although there was the sun in the sky, as if something huge covered this area of the forest with its shadow. According to John, the only way I could describe it was as if it was suddenly looking at the world through someone else's glasses that didn't fit my eyes. A jumble of figures that didn't make sense, end quote. Then, just as suddenly as it all happened, John reports that he seemed to have passed the barrier, that everything around him, quote, came back into focus, end quote. But now it was night, and the wind had completely stopped. Looking around, Larry found that the landscape had also changed. Instead of the fir trees that had surrounded him before, there was now dense, unrecognizable, and wild jungle-like vegetation, and that air seemed thick and depressingly damp. Sounds like the rainforest. Even though it was now night and there was no moon visible in the sky, he found that he could still see his surroundings, as if an unknown source of light illuminated the space. Then the air was pierced by a continuous, high, and piercing sound, which immediately filled him with an unbearable feeling of dread. Again, quoting Larry, it was at that moment that I heard the whisper of "Gotcha" over my right shoulder. I couldn't tell if I heard it with my ears or if it was with my head. I was so frightened that for one moment I felt my heart stop. I opened my mouth, gasped in a huge stream of thick air, and staggered back along the path I had come, here. When I looked back over my right shoulder, I saw a dark, hairy right hand reach for my throat over my shoulder. I'm going to stop right now and perhaps suggest that Larry may have been engaging in some sort of, I don't know, puff puff pass activity. I'm just suggesting. The hand had pale humanoid ivory fingers. The nails looked clean and almost manicured. Well, of course, Bigfoot often takes a break to manicure his or her fingernails. The thumb was placed lower on the hand than in humans. Both of the creature's arms were long and powerful, and both were covered in thick, coarse black hair. Again, quoting Larry, I got a good look at him because the nail of his thumb managed to brush against my neck, but did not break the skin. Oh, no. That's unfortunate. My neck had been a fraction of a second. I'm sorry. When I moved back. And then his hand squeezed where my neck had been a fraction of a second ago and left behind as I broke back through the portal. So it sounds like he went through the portal after smoking some wacky tobacco, apparently heard Bigfoot behind him say, "Gotcha." The guy might be slightly paranoid. Bigfoot then reaching over his shoulder, Larry's shoulder. Larry, in his heightened state, had the foresight to notice the well groomed. Perhaps manicured fingernails. All right. Because, folks, when I'm being choked by somebody, the first thing I notice is if they have manicured fingernails. As soon as Larry took a few more steps back, he was back in the normal world where there was a cool mountain air and familiar surroundings again. He saw that the portal ahead looked like an oval patch of shimmering air, which slowly disappeared until it disappeared altogether. Oh. So apparently, Bigfoot, the somewhat tall 7 to 9 foot creature with long flowing locks of body hair and a stench, hangs out in a place that, according to Larry, I want to make sure I get this right, according to Larry, dense, unrecognizable, and jungle-like vegetation, the air seemed thick and depressingly damp. That must be incredibly uncomfortable for Bigfoot. Yes, lots of nail files out in the forest. I mean, I get it. When dogs go running, the nails on their toes and paws, rather, right, naturally, right, groom themselves from running and digging and these sorts of things. So maybe that's how Bigfoot has, you know, well-manicured fingernails from digging up earth and decapitating heads from bodies and knocking over trees and busting down limbs. Larry then ran to his car as fast as he could without looking back. The terrified man later reflected on what had happened to him and came to the conclusion that it was some kind of interdimensional trap. Look, I'm going to put this link in the room for the story so you folks know I'm not just making this up. I'm not just making this up. Again, quoting Larry, on the way home, I was horrified at the thought of what would happen if I drove my pickup truck into something like that. It would be a trap in its purest form. Whatever tried to kill me, somehow the portal was hidden from me on the way in, and I didn't really see it until I went out again. I'm of the opinion that if Bigfoot wanted to kill you, he or she would have done so. I had terrible nightmares for years after that. I still don't realize what happened. My fingers are trembling, and the hairs on my back of my neck are standing up as I write this. Okay. There's another similar story. A certain Miss Montana's was driving in an unspecified year on a desert highway in east of El Paso, Texas, when she noticed the figure of a typical Yeti hovering over a dead coyote on the road. Again, I'll make the same comments I make when I read Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization stories where people don't remember the year. And my reply to that is, if this was such a traumatic event, how do you not remember not only the year, but the month, the date, and the approximate time, give or take 30 minutes? She, meaning Miss Montana's, slowed to get a better look at the strange creature and then saw that the massive form of the Yeti began to smoothly disappear into the ground, disappearing before her eyes until it disappeared altogether. Again, I'm not quite certain why a solo person driving a vehicle is going to slow down to check out what's hovering over roadkill. I don't know what a typical Yeti looks like, Pack Woman, but apparently, according to these people, tall, dark reddish or black hair, manicured fingernails, and apparently howls out a screech of something or other. At first, the woman, again, the woman being Miss Montana's, thought that the creature had hidden in some kind of cave. But when later this place was carefully examined by the researchers, they did not find any caves, tunnels, or something similar here. It is also curious that the coyote carcass disappeared along with the Yeti. Oh, well. Sometimes animals come and scrape up roadkill. If you want to, bottom of the page, you can follow these folks on various social media. I mean, just telling you folks, these are the things that keep some people up at night. These are the things that keep you up at night. Not to mention the infiltration of our planet by humanoid aliens, black-eyed children, and men in black. Independence Day and the War of the Worlds, which I actually watched last night, the remake with Tom Cruise. Special effects are okay. Are some of the motives that have been associated with humanoid alien invasion. In these movies, we are discussing attacks that affect the entire planet, cities that are leveled, and the deaths of millions of people. It's possible, however, that the invasion has already begun. One may wonder how this could be possible, but over the years, ufologists and researchers have interviewed individuals who have revealed their hazardous humanoid alien encounters on multiple occasions over the years. These same individuals, however, came to the conclusion that there are vast numbers. Let me repeat that. Vast numbers of extraterrestrials who are our adversaries, who look at least a little bit like us, and that they are slowly but surely making their way through our towns and cities. The first are these black-eyed children. They're among the creepiest modern-day humanoid aliens. They can be distinguished from humans at a glance, or if you're someone who is constantly on their phone. However, if you look closely, their skin will appear to be composed of plastic, and even some of them disguise their balding appearance by wearing wigs and hoodies. The black-eyed children are named for a reason. Their eyes are just like the ones on the cover of Whitley Strieber's classic 1987 book, Companion. I tend to find the Whitley Strieber story completely BS and BS as an S. That's just me. One of my favorite actors, Christopher Walken, plays the lead role in Communion. I mean, it's a classic film. I don't buy Whitley Strieber, but that's just me. In addition, the scary black-eyed children keep trying to break into people's homes. They've also been spotted all across the world, according to eyewitness accounts. Well, if they're breaking into people's homes, it's just one more reason to arm yourselves. Because if black, scary kids break into your home and they want to, I don't know, implant their alien eggs in you, you might want to lock and load. I'm not advertising you should just go randomly shoot people whom you believe are humanoid aliens. But if the black-eyed, scary children enter your house for whatever reason, and their goal is to implant you with alien eggs, you might want to pump off a few rounds. Apparently, a weird incident occurred in a Manhattan bookstore in early 1987. Apparently, you can read about this incident in the aforementioned Whitley Strieber book with a new one, Transformation, which was published in 1988. It sounds to me that these folks are trying to promote Whitley Strieber. Also, Ed Conrad's report on Communion, 1989. Both great works. Okay. In this case, the witness saw a woman who was disguised, veiled, and camouflaged, and who left a long-lasting effect on the individual. The woman was accompanied by a man. In late January of 1987, a man named Bruce Lee, who worked as a senior editor at a New York publishing house called William Morrow & Company, went into a bookstore on the Upper East Side of Manhattan with his wife. It was cold, dark, and icy outside. It was Womrath's, which used to be on Lexington Avenue. I've never been to New York, Manhattan, so I don't know. But it's now closed, so okay, now it's closed, so we can't go there. On that fateful Saturday afternoon, that wasn't the only strange thing that happened. Both the strange woman and the man were barely 5 feet tall, or even smaller. Huge black sunglasses and scarves covered their faces, while hats were tucked tightly under their chins. They appeared to be reading the book at a rapid pace, with the intention of correcting Strieber's mistakes out loud for Lee's benefit. Okay. I don't know what that means, but apparently incidents like the one I just mentioned are not very rare. Whether people like it or not, an increasing number of nasty and dangerous entities that resemble us but aren't us are on the rise. The level of infiltration isn't as high as it could be right now, but that doesn't preclude it from achieving enormous heights. The conflict, they have it in quotes, could begin at any time when these things are revealed for what humanoid aliens truly are or how they appear. Humans should be very cautious and aware of their surroundings. Yes, because, again, these are the things that I bring to you folks on this award-winning show. Never say the program is boring. Never say the program is boring. I bring you news that you need to know. Listen. If you're not a supporter of the Second Amendment, you better start lock and loading just because of the stories I read. Bigfoot, apparently now confirmed, utilize interdimensional portals. The aliens, the black-eyed children, are coming for you. Apparently they're breaking into your house. Yes, Pac, you should watch the movie Communion. It's actually, you know what? Let me see if I can... Let me see if I can. It's actually, I mean, I like, why can't I, here it is. We got the whole movie. I like Christopher Walken. Let me see if I can.
When was the last time you did a proper cleanse of your intestines? Maybe you do them often. Maybe you've never done
my chest.
But when most people hear the word cleanse.
It's the trailer. That's no fun. Apparently, there's no dialogue, but I put for you in the room, a Pac Woman, the link to the communion trailer. I mean, it doesn't. As movies go, it wasn't too bad. I mean, in that whole time frame, what? Fire in the Sky came out. Communion came out. Close Encounters was about a decade earlier. I mean, that was the whole era of, you know. Shortly after that, within 4 or 5 years, I think Independence Day came out. And I think you know the story of that, right? Some people thought that the reason all these movies within about a 10 to 15 year period regarding aliens and what have you came out because it was an attempt to desensitize the American public in preparation for the great alien invasion, which, last I checked, never happened. So, I'm just saying, it never happened, so maybe it will at some time. I don't know. I don't know if it's going to happen. If they're ever gonna come, but maybe they will. All right, folks, let's take a small break and head over to our friends over at Bedtime Stories. This week, the legend of the Dover Demon, for your listening pleasure. Quite scary. Quite scary.
America's northeastern states are a vast region of rolling woodland and mountain ranges, which are allegedly home to countless cryptids, seemingly able to traverse the unsettled areas of these states largely undetected. In April of 1977, the inhabitants of one small town in rural Massachusetts would catch an unwanted glimpse of one such creature. Join us as we investigate the legend of the Dover Demon. As her boyfriend Will had continued to steer the car through the winding country lanes, Abby Brabham sat beside him in the passenger seat, silently willing him to say something. The couple were on their way home from a party, during which an altercation had occurred between them. She had made an off-the-cuff remark about their relationship, which had caused him to lose his temper with her. It had only been 5 minutes since they had left, but those 5 minutes had seemed like an eternity, as he had still not said anything to her. She was beginning to worry that this might be more serious than she had initially believed. Sighing, she peered out of the passenger window at the surrounding countryside, as the passing tree lines and fields were briefly illuminated by the headlights of the car. By now, they were only a short distance from her home, leaving precious few minutes for Abby to try and resolve the situation before being dropped off. The 15-year-old was still frantically trying to think of a way to break the tension when she suddenly caught sight of something up ahead, squatting at the side of the road. As the car continued to move forwards, its probing headlights picked out a strange humanoid shape, settled on its hindquarters, staring at the approaching vehicle. Brabham gasped out loud as its features were gradually revealed by the piercing light from the high beams. Its oversized head sat atop an emaciated and painfully thin body, which was tan in color and possessed four long, spindly limbs. It was the creature's face which had shocked the girl most. It was entirely devoid of any kind of mouth or nose, but the eyes were a pair of almond-shaped pits, which seemed to regard her in a hungry and malevolent manner. As the vehicle passed by, they shined bright green in the headlights. It was at this moment, only meters away from the horror crouched at the side of the road, that Abby screamed. Her sudden outburst caused Will to slam his feet hard on the brakes. As his girlfriend sobbed and pointed out the rear window, he looked in the wing mirror to see the red hue of the brake lights reflecting off a short but spindly figure, which had now risen from the side of the road. For a moment, it seemed to study him, and then suddenly made off across the carriageway and into the undergrowth on the opposite side. In the days that followed, it would soon become clear that the young couple were not the only residents of the town to have had such an encounter, or to have been disturbed by this mysterious intruder's otherworldly appearance. Situated on the banks of the Charles River, roughly 15 miles to the southwest of Boston, the small town of Dover had historically led a quiet and unassuming existence. As one might expect, having produced few notable personalities and holding a large catalogue of local historical documents at its repository, the town had made little impact on the national scene. That was until the Easter of 1977, when a string of local teens reported haunting encounters with a strange and unnatural figure, which appeared to be stalking the fields and farmlands bordering the town. These incidents would turn out to be so traumatizing that great efforts were made to document them at the time they occurred, meaning a vivid and lasting profile of the entity was compiled, one which has endured decades of re-examination and investigation, cementing both the creature and the site of its appearance firmly in the history books. The first documented encounter with this unusual entity took place on the evening of April the 21st, as three teenagers were driving home across town. The Volkswagen in which they were travelling was driven by its owner, Bill Bartlett, who was giving his two friends Mike Mazzocca and Andy Brody a lift to their respective homes. The trio had been travelling northwards along Farm Street, when Bartlett caught sight of something straddling a low-lying stone wall, which was situated not far from the left-hand side of the road. At first, the youth believed that what he was seeing was most likely a roaming pet, such as a cat or dog, but as the car drew closer, he quickly realized that it was in fact nothing of the sort. As the light shining upon it began to intensify, Bartlett was able to make out a series of horrifying and nightmarish features. The creature was too big to be a domestic cat, standing about 3.5 feet tall and being distinctly humanoid in appearance. Its emaciated torso seemed far too inadequate to support the bulbous head which sat atop its shoulders, and which was devoid of any features, save for a pair of large orange eyes. There was no fur covering its naked body, the skin of which appeared to be rough like sandpaper and was coloured somewhat like a peach. The bizarre-looking creature was slowly and methodically crabbing its way across the top of the wall, its tendril-like fingers curling around the stones in order to gain a sufficient grip. As the car drove by, the entity quickly melted away into the darkness. Bartlett excitedly asked his passengers if they too had seen it, only to be met with confused expressions. Immediately upon his return home from having dropped off his friends, the youth quickly told his father what had taken place, and then drew a detailed picture of what he had seen. Little did he know it at the time that this would not be the only sketch of the creature composed that evening. Several hours later, on the other side of the town and at the southern end of Miller Hill Road, 15-year-old John Baxter had also been making his way home. He had just spent several hours at his girlfriend's house and was conscious that he would most likely be in trouble upon his return due to the lateness of the hour. As he hurried through the empty streets towards his destination, the youth caught sight of another pedestrian walking towards him from the opposite direction. Initially believing his fellow traveller to be a younger child due to its short stature, Baxter had slowed his pace to investigate, only for the figure opposite to immediately follow suit. With the skies above being overcast and the person ahead of him being stood just outside the illuminating hue of a nearby streetlight, Baxter could make out very little detail. Whoever it was remained completely still and seemed to regard him. Then, in an instant, the figure had turned and scurried off to the left, disappearing into a wooded gully which happened to run alongside the road. Breaking into a sprint, Baxter gave chase, hearing the sounds of rustling leaves and snapping twigs up ahead as he began to gain ground. Seconds later, the boy found himself standing at the bottom of the gully, quite alone, or so he thought. Quietly surveying his surroundings, he noticed an unnatural shape, standing on top of a large rock off to the side of a tree about 30 meters away. In that moment, a shaft of moonlight peered out from beyond the cloud cover, providing just enough luminosity to make out the details of what lurked before him. In the dim light, John Baxter saw something unlike anything he had ever seen before. It was a bizarre-looking creature with a pale, simian-like body, possessing a painfully thin neck, which seemed to be struggling to support its grossly oversized head. The face staring back at him across the short distance was completely blank and devoid of any features, save for two dark patches where the eyes should have been. Now terrified that this creature may have lured him away from the town in order to attack him, Baxter turned and ran as fast as he could, finally emerging onto the main road. A few minutes later, a passing car had slowed down to investigate. It was driven by a young couple, who were sufficiently concerned by the boy's emotional state to offer him a lift home. The image of the alleged creature which Baxter went on to draw would prove to be eerily similar to the one produced by Bill Bartlett. The same can be said of a third image, which would go on to be drawn as a result of Abby Brabham's encounter the following evening. The various sketches and interpretations of the creature, which would in time become known as the Dover Demon, are perhaps the most significant reason this strange series of sightings remains such an enduring mystery. Some commentators have highlighted what they believe to be similarities between the being's featureless face and wide-eyed stare and witness testimony of traditional grey extraterrestrials. But the absence of an accompanying spacecraft or similar technology during the Dover encounters would seem to contradict this theory. The fact that the entity made no effort to approach or communicate with any of the witnesses, instead choosing to evade them on every occasion, has led many to suggest that it may have been some form of cryptid. Massachusetts possesses many areas of rugged and inaccessible terrain, largely untouched by human beings. It is perhaps little surprise, then, that the state has played host to a high percentage of cryptid encounters. These include reported sightings of Sasquatches, the giant-winged Thunderbird, and the enigmatic Puckwudgies, dwarf-like hominids which were first referenced in the stories of Native Americans. Anthropologists who have studied the case have pointed out that all three of the Dover Demon encounters took place in close proximity to local water sources. This suggests that whatever the creature may have been, it is possible that it was attempting to remain close to its natural habitat. In the aftermath of the incidents, a local resident named Mark Senott would later come forward, providing details of an even older encounter with the creature. He would describe an incident in which he had been driving through the town one evening during the summer of 1972, when he had been startled by something which had run across the road in front of him. This unknown creature was notably short in stature and was running upright on two legs, possessing a pair of brightly illuminated eyes. After Senott had brought his car to a stop, he had watched the running figure reach the nearby woods, where it had then disappeared from sight at the edge of a large pond, which was situated there. It has been highlighted that all the sightings took place during the hours of darkness, and when plotted on a map, they appear to track in a straight line which passes directly through or across the local area. This raises the argument that whatever the witnesses observed may have been migrating or travelling in a set direction, as if the town itself may not have been of any interest or consequence to the entity. As is common with sightings of unknown creatures or alleged monsters, rational explanations for what has been seen are numerous. There have been suggestions that the creature observed by the teenagers may have been an orphan moose cub, in possession of a very pale pelt of fur. These animals have very long and spindly legs, and it has been proposed that in poor light conditions, their gait could be mistaken for a taller creature walking or running with its upper torso bent forwards. However, Dover does not lie anywhere near any regional moose habitats. To counter this somewhat inconvenient fact, similar hypotheses have been put forward. Some suggest that the Dover demon could have been an albino calf, or some other animal which had escaped from a local collection, such as an exotic ape or monkey, or even a disfigured forest animal. And yet a simple glance at the creature depicted in the drawings by the teenagers at the time of the encounters suggests that what they saw could not have been any known species. There are simply too many commonalities in these sketches of something which did not resemble or even move like anything they had ever seen before. Is it possible that the children were the victims of some elaborate hoax, or that they were instead the perpetrators of one? In the half century since the incident, there have been no further sightings of the creature in the town, or indeed anything which resembles what they saw. That said, creatures of a similar description have been seen elsewhere across the globe. In 1996, for instance, Brazilian authorities were reported to have captured a being in Virginia, which closely resembled the one seen in Massachusetts in 1977. As it stands, without any evidence to back up the testimonies of those involved, and without a convincing enough argument to logically explain what they saw, the events of that fateful weekend in Dover remain one of America's most intriguing mysteries. We have already explored a variety of unusual cryptid sightings which are alleged to have taken place within the USA, and as time passes, such incidents continue to occur, often accompanied by dash cam or mobile phone footage of the creatures involved. It is possible that at some future time, the evidence needed to verify the existence of the Dover demon may yet surface, and in doing so, answer the questions which remain about what took place in this sleepy and unassuming northeastern community.
My guess is that it was a calf, or as they say in Europe, an albino calf, as opposed to albino calf. I don't know. It could be. Could be something completely different, or just people are just making it up as they go along. That's what I tend to say a lot. They're just making it up as they go along, like most people do. But who knows? All right, folks. a few minutes of copyrighted free music. I'm kidding. That's no fun. I'm kidding. Actually, do you guys remember? I'm going to play something for you and ask you if you remember Miss Cleo, the supposed Jamaican psychic from the Psychic Radio Network. If you don't recognize the name, I think you might recognize this.
Don't you really want to know?
Okay, I was wondering who the father of my baby was.
All right, let's take a look. The Miss Cleo DNA test.
First of all, did you hear her break her Jamaican accent when she says the Miss Cleo DNA test? She broke her Jamaican accent. Listen carefully.
All right, let's take a look. The Miss Cleo DNA test.
There it is. She broke it.
I'm solely searching for the father of your baby.
Father of your baby.
Oh, it's the one that's very unpleasant.
Okay. See, it doesn't even sound like a Jamaican accent. Miss Cleo was not great fleespiration. Her name wasn't even Miss Cleo, and she was born in Los Angeles, California. But you know what? In her defense, she was not... I think she's on record as saying that over the course of 2 years, she made about $450,000. That's what she was paid. And I think she was paid about 24 cents per minute. So this is how it worked, if you didn't know. First, let me finish Miss Cleo.
Okay. And he's also the one that had another girlfriend while he was sleeping with you.
First of all, she's basing it on statistics. If you are, do I dare say, back in the day, a young a colored woman, from, or most often any impregnated woman, and you were not married, living in, you know, do I dare say, any area of the U.S., and you became pregnant by your, quote, boyfriend, end quote, chances were very great that he had a couple of ladies on the side. A student from the great continent of Africa once asked me, he was unfamiliar with marriage in the U.S. He said, well, how many wives can you have? We said, well, in the state I was in at the time, South Dakota, you can technically only be legally married to one woman. And some guy turned around and said, but you can have as many girlfriends as you want to, which I thought was the funniest thing I've heard in a long time. So, yes. Chances are very great that this woman had a dude, and he had some ladies on the side.
Yes, he did.
Yep, that's him. That's the daddy.
Okay.
But you knew that.
I wasn't sure.
You see how strong her Jamaican accent gets?
I don't know how. The baby looks just like him.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, so you were in denial, because he has a funny little chin, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, and the baby have that same little chin.
Oh, my God.
The cards can reveal things that you will never see by yourself. Call me now for your free tarot reading.
Call 1-800-980-8637.
So this is how Miss Cleo and the Psychic Radio Network, PRN, worked. First of all, her real name was Uri Del Harris. She was born in 62. Sadly, she passed away, I think, of was it colon cancer? Yeah, colorectal cancer. It metastasized, and she passed away while she was in hospice in Palm Beach, Florida, on July 26th of 2016 at the young age of 53. But I used to make the mistake, and others made the mistake, that they thought Miss Chloe was, like, in charge of this whole thing. No, she wasn't. She's gone on record. You can find this in various parts of the Internet, that over a course of 2 years she was with the organization, she essentially made about $450,000, and she got a little extra money for these info commercials. And she seems like a nice person. But this is what ended up happening, is people who became Airfinger quote psychics basically applied for a job and said, hey, make up to $12 an hour. So yes, in fact, it is true that the calls were free for the first 5 minutes, But that was once you dialed the number and the pickup occurred on the other end, which means you could be on hold for 5 minutes, or somebody could pick up within a minute and a half, and in the next 3.5 minutes, they're basically just, you know, trying to get the spiritual vibe, and they had scripts to go by and all this stuff. So this is how they were paid. Miss Cleo was paid for about 24 cents per minute for as long as she kept people on. Folks were charged, I think, $4.99 a minute. And the average bill that people received for these calls was somewhere around, you know, $60. Right? So you're talking 12 minutes, a total of 17 minutes. If you figure the 5 minutes free and then 12 minutes. So Cleo got about 24 cents a minute. Everybody else got roughly, I think, between 8 cents and 12 cents a minute. So the goal was the longer you kept those folks on, the more you made, but the more cents per minute you earned. And if you didn't keep people on long enough, your phone rang less. And these weren't people who were living, who were hanging out in you know, some big call shop. You would apply for it and they would, they would call the 900 number that would be forwarded to your home location. So some of these folks, you were just calling and they were, you know, in another state, maybe another time zone. They were just reading scripts. So that's how it worked. Yes, blah. She made about 450 grand total over the course of 2 years, which, you know, was a shit ton of money back in, you know, 1989, 88 or so, right? A decent chunk of money. But no, she wasn't Jamaican. So if you kept people on longer, phone calls were funneled to those numbers more often than if somebody, you know, only kept them on for a total of 7 minutes, five of which was technically the free. Then they only got, what would have been, $9.98 for the $4.99 a minute. So that's how it worked. But this place raked in, B as in boy, billions of dollars. And the FCC got involved, and then there was a – the FCC got involved. What was the payout? I'm sorry, Psychic Friends Network. The PFN, the Psychic Friends Network. I gotta find the lawsuit. What was the lawsuit? About, I guess it was $3.99 a minute. Apparently one caller paid more than $600. But yeah, but they had scripts to read by, and it was all just general stuff. You know, somebody at work is jealous of you. You have a former lover who can't stop thinking about you, and they're trying to get in touch with you. there's a member of your family that is not feeling well. You have a lot of stress from work. It's like, it's a cold reading. A cold reading is when you throw out just a bunch, I think it's a bunch of general sort of statements, and you rely on the cues from the individuals, which is why during that 5 minutes, if you got on the free 5 minutes, they'd ask you a bunch of questions. You know, what field are you in? How old are you? Do you have any children? And my thought is, well, you're a psychic. You should be able to figure this stuff out. Who was that one somewhat famous psychic crossing over with John Edwards? Right, he was criticized. There's a psychic dude on the Hulu channel or something. But it's all just, here's my point. If you're a psychic dude and you know somebody's future, you should pull them aside and say, look, I see heart disease. I see a heart attack in the next 6 months. You might want to change your diet. Right, stuff like this. But it's all just a sham, right? Look, I'll tell you right now. I'm going to read my daily horoscope today. I was born in January, so I'm an Aquarius. It's always easy to win the admiration you expect from your partner. Wait, hang on. We're going to read more. May 9th. It isn't always easy to win the admiration you expect from your partner while I'm single. But in this area, today seems to be better than most. You're likely to be brimming with ideas for ways to enhance your most appealing qualities. But don't overdo it. Your efforts at physical or intellectual seduction are more effective when they're subtle. First of all, I'm single. This doesn't apply to me at all. This doesn't apply to me at all. There will be no physical or intellectual seduction going on today because I'm single. Today's horoscope does not apply to me at all. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. I don't know what we. Yeah, you and the one twelfth of the world pop. I don't know what that means, Pat. No, I think it's all it's psychics like social like horoscopes throw out blanket statements that if you read could apply to your dog. But again, it's just one person's opinion, and we're all free to it, which makes this country great. Here comes the top of the hour music, folks. I'll talk with you shortly.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
The pill has been taken. Blinders are off. Are we in the end game, or are we simply living a replay of a time that's already happened, with no choices? Different people have different points of view. When it comes to creation versus evolution, my point of view, we were created to evolve. The Red Pill, every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution, Revolution. Radio! Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, we're back. Okay, I got it now, Pat. I was just reading it. I was just reading what you were saying. Yeah, so Miss Cleo was a complete scam, and folks paid a lot of money for it. But folks pay a lot of money for a lot of scams. Who was the guy? Remember when Hale Bopp was coming, and there was some minister person, a religious based person that. No, it wasn't that. Was it Hale Bopp or was it the end of the world? I forget. 2020. Not 2020, no. When was it? This had to have been sometime in post-2002. Anyway, I forget which. There were so many of them. It wasn't Heaven's Gate. Those are the people who committed suicide. That was Hale Bopp. I'm thinking of something else. Where people gave their life savings and stuff, and the end of the world never came, and those poor people didn't get their life savings back. That's too bad. Oh, I forgot to mention this. I am sorry. You are tuned in to Revolution Radio. Remember, we are 100% listener-supported. Every donation that you make goes to support this 800,000-watt blowtorch. A couple of ways to support us, and here's how you do that. Head over to freedomslips.com, common spelling in your favorite internet browser, top of the page. Click on the store tab first. You will see a large number of items created by our own a mad painter. You may know him as Thomas. We've got skull mouse pads. We've got coffee cups or coffee mugs. We have a number of items. We also have a 15% off sale going on. I'm still looking for my cup, and I don't see it yet. My cup is not here yet. Where's my cup? My cup isn't here yet. All right. Well, I guess I'm not cup worthy. Anyway. Did I scare you, Cat? The handle of the chair got caught under the desk, so it scared the cat because he is a true Freddy cat. So donations go to support the from the store. Items purchased from the store go to support the radio station to keep us afloat. Also, donations tab, become a Patreon, the donor box, direct payments North America only, por favor. We do have some cryptocurrency options, or you can write a check and drop it in the mail. Bottom of the page, it'll make its way to Allen, Michigan. Never been there, but I heard it's nice. Another way to support us is click on the schedule tab. If you click on the schedule tab, first you'll see a UK clock, a US clock, and an Australia clock. You'll see Studio A as well as Studio B. Somebody please explain to me why on Studio A for the last 2 months, from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern time, it has been reserved Monday through Friday, and I've seen it for 2 months. When is this person starting, and who's reserving this time slot? Somebody tell me. Is it Pac-Woman? Is Pac-Woman having her own morning show from 10 a.m. to noon, Monday through Friday, on Studio B and nobody on Studio A? I'm sorry, nobody told me. Is that what's going on? Number of open slots on Studio B. So if you believe you have the gift for gab, head on over, click on schedule, find the studio, the time slot, make sure the time block has the word open in it, then go back to the top of the page, click on the contact tab from the homepage, send a mad painter and lady horse an email, and you, my fine feathered friend, will soon find yourself, perhaps maybe if you're lucky, in a host review committee meeting. Well, they will review you to see if you're worthy of it. Oh, I see two good-looking people, three good-looking people. I see Pat Rabbit in the room. I see the right Reverend, Dr., Mr. Rowe, and Jerbear. Speaking of Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III, you can check out his award-winning program. I can't ever find anything on. I had this so planned out, and for some reason, I can't find it. I can't find it. Where is it? I see everybody else's show except for Pat's. Damn it. Where is not? Why can't I find it? Okay, seriously, this is quite embarrassing. Why can I not find? I must have passed it 8 times. There it is. Thank you very much. Not for Public Consumption on Studio B from noon Eastern till 2 p.m. Eastern with Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III. Now, I did mention that we have some cryptocurrency options. If you want to know everything about cryptocurrency, tune into Studio A at 4 p.m. Eastern time, Crypto Corner, with the great retired Reverend Dr. Mr. Rowe. Thank you. I'm sorry, Pat. I'm sorry. I was having a missing 411 moment when you pass something numerous times and you don't see it. See how easy that is, kids? See how easy it is to pass something and not be able to see it? So there is my attempt at seriously. I've had people ask me, so what do you do on Mondays and Thursdays? And I say, whatever I want to. They go, isn't it hard? And I go, no, it's not hard. I don't know how you folks approach your programs, but I basically now try to find the most outlandish stories and share them with you for your pleasure, because I'm of the opinion that between the hours of 6 a.m., your favorite morning show, and 5 p.m. before I come on, even after, it's a lot of the same type of topics, which is fine. But that's one thing that I appreciate about this station is that everybody has their own special little niche or niche, right? We all have our own little topics. I think Sirius Sunflower's Poetry Hour is fabulous. I got cat hair in my mouth. If I was not afraid I would be lynched from some of the folks, I would go on my rant about the Marvel Universe and how Doctor Strange 2 is the biggest piece of shite in the history of Marvel movies. In one man's opinion, but I'm not going to. But if you think this is difficult, it's not. I describe it this way. Pretend you're sitting at a table having a beverage of your choice. Coffee, tea, unsweetened iced tea, hot cocoa, a lager, wine, ice water, whatever it is. And you're essentially having a conversation with somebody, and it's based around the following, I got a cat hair in my mouth. The following presentation. Hey, have you heard about, that's really it. You're just kind of having a conversation with this evening, 27 people and in the chat room and however many are tuned into this station and however many are, listening online, right? Just having a conversation. So if you have ever wondered, hey, I wonder if I could. Yes, you can. Right? So head over to freedomslips.com. Click on the schedule tab. Look for open slots. And I'll tell you this right now. The first time I was on the air, the first person to ever Skype call me. I know I give them a little bit of crap here and there, but it's all out of love. But one of the people that I still to this day appreciate, not the most, but is in the category of folks that I appreciate, because Jerbear was the first one to Skype call me. And I don't know if it lasted a half hour or an hour, right? And he just kind of introduced himself, welcomed me. I mean, Jerbear does a haul on Saturday and Sunday mornings. I mean, he hosts after hours from Sunday morning on Studio A from 4 a.m. to 9 a.m. That's 5 hours. Then again on Saturday morning, again from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m., that's a haul. I don't think the guy sleeps. So that's 10 hours of radio over a 2-day period, which is a long haul. Right? Because if you remember this, we're not, some people have producers and some people work with other people and that's cool and everything. A percentage of the stuff that I have obviously comes from sources. I don't make it up. I don't pull it out of thin air. You know, you gotta do a little bit of homework. But this isn't one of those situations where you've got, you know, a team, and I'll define team as you and somebody else, so two people, or a producer that is, you know, getting your show together. You know that most big city radio stations subscribe to companies that provide morning show prep? You know that, right? Oh, yeah. It's in most morning shows, with the exception of, you know, a few. I'm talking about those, you know, back in the, you know, 80s. In the 90s, a lot of morning shows, you know, bubblegum radio, you know, the Pookie DJs, how you doing? Yeah, you know, those folks. A lot of that was just morning show prep produced by other stations, I mean, by companies. Or they had a team, you know, 2-3 people of folks that would produce their morning shows. So, you know, they'd say, hey, this is what's going on. Here are the hot Hollywood type items. And they'd break up. Most morning shows would run from 5 a.m. local time until, let's say, 9 a.m., right? So it's that prime time of people wake up, you know, the morning drive. They're driving to work. Most folks work at 9 a.m. And then you've got the midday 9 to noon, 9 to 1, 9 to 2, then kind of the 2 to 6, right, the drive home, and then the 6 to whatever, and then the overnight for the third shifters. But in that, you know, let's say central time, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m., that 4-hour block, people would always ask, well, so Pastor, you find your own producer. How do you I'm sorry, I'm reading the chat. I don't know if Plytus is so far off. He's just, you know, he's got his own thing going on, I guess. He's got his own niche. So yes, he's not far off, but he has his own niche and the folks that follow him. But people would ask, okay, how do you take a 5 a.m. Central Time morning drive show to 9 a.m. and how do you cover 4 hours? Well, you don't cover 4 hours. That's really not how it is. And I'm gonna get a piece of paper out and diagram this for myself as I talk to you about it. So right, if you take your standard hour clock and let's say you break it into 15-minute quarters, right? So you got 15, 30, 45, right, and then 60. Most radio shows have their first break at about 12 after the hour. And depending on the drive time, as they say, so the most expensive drive time 30-second, 60-second ads are morning and evening drive, right? So those commercials run anywhere between, you know, 3 to 5 total minutes of commercials, somewhere in there. So normally at 12 after you've got a break, somewhere between like 8 and 12 after the hour. Then another one between, you know, like 27 and 32 after the hour. And then again, somewhere around, you know, 42 to 45, a quarter of the hour. Then there's always a break at around 57 minutes. That's why the FCC, I think it's still a requirement that you have to give the full station ID between 5 minutes, I think it's 10 minutes to and 10 minutes after the hour. You got a 20-minute window. So normally that's, so the top of the hour you'll hear, this is, you know, WFUK Seattle, Washington playing the best hits from the 80s, 90s, and whenever somebody else was born or whatever it is. So that's the legal ID, right? Top of the hour. So if you figure in your 60-second hour, you're covering, let's say if each break is 3 minutes long, you're already covering 12 minutes, right? 3, 6, 9, 12.
12 minutes of time. That takes it down to 48 minutes. Well, within morning drive and what have you, you normally have, you know, no more than two songs back to back. So let's say in that whole hour, you've got a total of let's say it's five total songs in that hour. And each song lasts, let's just say each song lasts 2 minutes, okay? Now you got 10 minutes, right? So now you're down to 38 minutes within that hour block. And then within that hour block of 38 minutes, you just simply kind of break that 38 minutes down into, you know, let's say, like four little segments. Well, each segment is going to last about 9 minutes. You know, segments could be, you know, calls with you know, it's News of the Weird or some BS like that. The Hollywood Dirt, some BS like that. You tie in normally weather, traffic, and all that stuff. So really, kind of like the Rocky Balboa movie, I think the Rocky Balboa movie, in the entire movie, there's literally like 20 minutes of dialogue in that, and everything else is music montages and what have you. So if you think about morning drive and afternoon in the drive home, as they say, you probably have maybe collectively, I dropped my pen, maybe collectively, if you exclude commercials, you exclude music, if you out of like 60 minutes, if you account for music, traffic, weather, commercials, music, you know, 10 minutes, traffic, weather, let's say it's going to be 5 minutes total, commercials, let's say, again, it's going to be, 12 minutes total. So right now we're at, 27 minutes. Then you figure you've got, 33 minutes of rambling. You probably have in each hour probably about 20 total minutes of talking. I'm just guessing. I mean, you really, in each hour, you probably have 20 total minutes of talking. Because there's always little, BS going around. There's always, it's the wacky news. It's sort of this and that. So, and if all you've got to do is as a producer, be able to cover 25 minutes and break that up into segments, because normally you've got four commercial breaks. And if you're doing four commercial breaks and you got 24 minutes, I mean, do the math, right? You've got to cover 6 minutes of talking. In between two people or even three people, because normally you've got, the main dude, and then you've got, the guy who just says some things here and there doesn't mean anything. And then you've got, the kind of stereotypical other person who just is there for shits and giggles. That's kind of how it works. So that's the secret. People seem to think that morning shows and all this is rocket science. It's not. It's like anything in life, in my opinion, it's right thing, right time, right place. And that's a quote from Gene Simmons from Kiss. He was being interviewed once on a radio show, and somebody asked him, how did Kiss become successful, or this and that, or life advice, or whatever it was. And he said it was, regarding at least Kiss, and other things in life, you have to make certain that you have found the right thing, it's the right time, and it's the right place. I mean, I'll bring back the there's a Twitch streamer, and he had mentioned that when he first started streaming, he didn't do very well. He maybe had an average of maybe 100 or so viewers, and for somebody who wants to make a full time living of that, that's not a lot, because you rely on, well, first of all, you sign a contract with Twitch. Then you rely on donations, subscriptions, somebody becomes a sub and a portion of that, depending on the tier you get. The more viewers you have, the more likely you are to receive a higher percentage of that subscription. Your contract is a little higher, et cetera, et cetera. But he said that he decided that it wasn't working. So what he did is he basically wrote a small, I think he said he wrote a small algorithm and found out what time blocks all across Twitch had the least amount of viewers. So he found the Goldie, the honey spot. He found the Goldilocks spot, right? Within there. And he started streaming during that block where it had there weren't a lot of people streaming. So he didn't have to worry about a lot of competition. I think this is how he explained it. So what ended up happening is then his viewership grew, and once it was sustained, even though other people came into that spot, he was able to sustain his viewership. And, you know, he averages somewhere between, 15 and 20,000 viewers a stream, and he does, 8 hours collectively each day. He gave a tour of his studio, and he said, look, you guys – allow me to do this. I mean, this house must have cost him $750,000, right? There are streamers that make a crap ton of money, and if you and I don't know how reliable this is, but if you just simply this is from 2000 in I don't want to use this. I want to use a better site. I don't even know if this is even it. Okay, so here's an article that was confirmed by Twitch that basically said, all right, this is how much people make. So you got to scroll down. So, I mean, these are the salaries. What Twitch paid streamers at least in 2019. So you've got people, the range is 9.6 million all the way down to 2 million. I mean, the guy I mentioned makes 2 million a year. You know? And I'm not saying that's just for playing video games, but people make a crap ton of money, doing it. Making $2 million as a mid-20-year-old playing video games, my hope is that you've saved the money. My hope is that you have saved the money. All right, so I think I've rambled on enough about, Twitch and what have you, right? Let's head over to bedtime stories. Once again.
In the dark stretches between our towns and cities, there lies millions upon millions of miles of road. These paved networks are the lifeblood of our economies and facilitate our connections with the wider world. They also provide the settings for some of the most disturbing encounters on record. Join us as we explore these highways of horror. The highways and byways of our world have always nurtured undertones of fear and trepidation. Historically, they were frequented by bandits and robbers, simply because they offered far more lucrative opportunities than the relative bastions of the towns and cities they connected. Travelling along them was always a risk, even in broad daylight. But with the advent of motor transport, the spectre of the traditional highwayman slowly but surely began to diminish. As vehicles evolved over time, becoming capable of far greater speeds and security, it became much more difficult for lone gunmen to take advantage. And in that relative absence of any real threat, people began to find other things to fear whilst travelling. stories of high strangeness, from dark and desolate backroads to open highways are nothing new, suggesting the dark energies therein predate the likes of Dick Turpin and his highwayman. What follows is a small selection of stories from people who make a living from driving on our roads, often in the dead of night. Our first tale comes by way of Jakob Klaar, an Estonian national living and working in the UK. Back in the early 90s, Jakob worked for a Russian company situated on the outskirts of Pskov, which meant that 5 days out of seven, he laboured in a foreign country away from his family. Every Sunday evening, he would make the 2.5-hour commute from Tartu in eastern Estonia, crossing the Russian border to the south. Every Friday afternoon, he would retrace this journey to spend the weekend with his loved ones. One Sunday evening at around 11 p.m, Jakob was well over an hour into his drive. The border checkpoint was well behind him, and he now found himself travelling along the 58K333, a minor transit route surrounded by endless tracts of countryside. It is nothing more than a tributary, which feeds into the E77 highway to the south. However, there was nothing minor about what Jakob would encounter on this otherwise mundane stretch of road. He was already missing his family. His wife had just given birth to a baby girl, the second addition to their young brood. His other child, a boy, had just turned 3 and was becoming quite the chatterbox. He was just thinking how much nicer it would be to find employment closer to home, when he noticed a distant light in his rearview mirror. It was coming fast up the road behind him. As it got closer, the brightness intensified, and naturally assuming it was another vehicle, Jakob shouted in frustration, willing the other driver to dip their headlights. Soon, they were right up behind him, sitting on his tail, so close that it would have caused a major accident if he'd even slightly touched the brake pedal. "What the hell is this guy doing?" Jakob mumbled to himself, and no sooner had the words left his lips than he heard the sound of the boot or trunk catch being released. Suddenly the interior light came on, and the sound of rushing wind was heard, as cold air blasted in from the rear of the vehicle. As he looked back, he realized that the boot lid was now wide open, but the headlights which were there behind him just a split second before had vanished. He pulled over at the earliest opportunity and exited his vehicle. He glanced up and down the road, looking for any sign of the other driver. It was deathly quiet. No other vehicles could be seen or heard. Confused, Jakob closed the boot lid, got back into his car, and continued on his way. He had been on the road less than a minute when the light reappeared in the distance once more, again coming up fast behind his car. He noticed that it was a singular light source, and began to suspect that it was a motorcyclist playing games with him. As it settled on his tail, Jakob again heard the catch of his boot lid release, and sure enough, when he looked back, the tailgate was wide open, and the light had disappeared. Frustrated, he pulled over again, and this time made sure the boot lid was locked. But instead of continuing along his route, he turned the car around and headed back the way he came, hoping to catch the motorcyclist sitting in a lay-by further up the road. To his utter disbelief, almost as soon as he started moving, the light reappeared in the distance behind him, closing in at supernatural speed. This was impossible, as he knew full well that nobody had come past him when he stopped the car the second time. Nevertheless, the exact same sequence of events played out, and Jakob found himself having to stop once again to close his boot lid. He was completely dumbfounded, as he knew he had locked it. Something was obviously not right about the situation, and he began to feel more than a little spooked. When the light reappeared a fourth time, with Jakob having resumed his original route, he decided he'd had enough. When it reached the back of his car, he suddenly slammed on his brakes and the light flew over the top of his vehicle and off into the night sky, never to be seen again. He was so disturbed by the whole experience that he quickly made good on his intention to find work closer to home. In July 2014, a truck driver by the name of Paul Drew found himself parked up on a stretch of US Highway 95, about 50 miles north of Las Vegas. Paul had been delegated a task known as a meet and turn. This is where two truck drivers start out from different points and meet halfway to swap their trailers over, then turn around and head home. This was a common assignment for Paul, and he often found himself arriving an hour or two before the other driver showed up, and he would take the opportunity to catch up on some sleep. On this night, he'd arrived at his meeting point at around 2 a.m. It was a dark lot right in the middle of the Nevada desert, and to his surprise, he found that it was completely empty. On any other night, there would have been at least a few other trucks present, but he thought nothing of it, and settled into his sleeper compartment for a nap. After about 10 minutes, he was just beginning to doze off, when he was suddenly shaken wide awake by the sound of a dog barking. This struck him as odd given the location. The nearest small town was about 20 miles away, and he couldn't have imagined someone's pet wandering this far into the wilderness. The possibility that it was a coyote had briefly occurred to him, but it sounded like a much larger dog. He realized the animal was close. In fact, it sounded as if it was standing right outside his cab. Climbing out of his sleeper, he peeked out of the driver's side window, and to his surprise, in the dim moonlight he saw the outline of a tall man standing there. He assumed this was the dog's owner. In that precise moment, he didn't know what to make of the situation, so he simply grabbed his flashlight and opened the window to talk to the stranger. But when his torch illuminated the scene, he recoiled. As the light passed over the man's face, he could see that it was in fact the man who was barking. There was no dog. His expression was sinister, snarling and inhuman in the way his mouth twisted and contorted when making the sound, and his eyes looked beady and aggressive, almost like a hostile dog's eyes. His bark did not sound like a human trying to impersonate a dog. It sounded exactly like a dog. Paul was so flummoxed by what he was seeing that all he could do was stare at this apparently deranged individual. After a minute or two, he turned away to grab his phone, hoping to record the commotion on camera. But when he turned back, he found that the man had disappeared and the barking had entirely ceased. His flashlight flitted back and forth across the lot, but he could see no sign of the tall man whatsoever. There was nowhere he could have gone in such a short space of time. Somewhat alarmed by the experience, he decided to remain inside his cab until the other driver arrived more than an hour later. His colleague didn't know what to make of his story, and put it down to the inherent high strangeness of Nevada State. Paul himself has never been able to shake the imperishable feeling that there was something beyond normal about his encounter, from the man's weird and inhuman expression to his impossible disappearance and the fact that it all happened out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by miles and miles of desert. A year earlier in 2013, a delivery driver working for UPS in Washington, D.C., had an unlikely encounter with the men in black. Jim Wise had only been in the job for about 2 months, but quickly slipped into the monotony of delivering parcels in and around the US Capitol. There was one particular building, the location of which he would not divulge, which was a regular drop-off point on his rounds. At least every other day, he would be required to deliver a parcel there. The premises were highly secure, surrounded by high fences, and the only way to gain access was via an intercom system on the main gate. Upon entry, Jim's routine would be to drive up to the main reception, press the buzzer, and hand the deliveries over to the usually uptight receptionist in exchange for her signature. One cold and frosty morning in January, he found himself driving through the main gate of the site once again, but this time when he buzzed reception, there was no answer. He tried a number of times and waited for a couple of minutes before deciding to drive around to the rear of the building. He thought that maybe there was a loading bay somewhere and that he could drop the parcels off there instead. But as he rounded the corner, he was met by a bizarre scene. About 20 feet further back from the main complex, there was another, slightly smaller building with a sheltered walkway connecting the two. Underneath the shelter, walking towards the smaller premises, were three men, all dressed in dark suits and wearing fedora hats. Jim was taken aback by how incredibly tall and slim they were. Each of them was nearing the 7-foot mark, but their legs and arms were stick thin, their waists barely the width of one of the delivery driver's thighs. Even more shocking was the way they walked, their movements all perfectly in sync with each other, but haphazard and all over the place, as if they were having trouble standing upright. They disappeared into the smaller building a short time later, leaving Jim sitting there for a moment, wondering what on earth he had just witnessed. He would go on to state how it's difficult to put into words just how surreal and unnatural these men looked, but he is steadfast in his conviction that it unnerved him to the core. Unfortunately for him, it would not be the last he saw of them. Realizing that there was nowhere else to deliver his parcels, he made his way back around to the front of the main complex, and this time, when he buzzed reception, a man answered the door and invited him in. The man, who was also dressed in a dark suit, asked him to bring the parcels through, and led him down a short corridor and into another room. To his surprise, the room was small and completely devoid of furniture, and there were five other men in dark suits, all standing in a semicircle, facing him. Alarmed, he tried to back out of the doorway, but the man who showed him in had already closed the door behind him and ordered him to put the parcels down. At first, he thought he was looking at a group of mannequins, as the men in front of him had not moved an inch. They were tall and thin like the others, and were stood absolutely stock still and deathly quiet. Their skin was waxy and pale, and their lifeless eyes did not even move to follow him as he placed the parcels on the floor. For the next 5 minutes, the delivery driver was grilled by the man who had answered the door, asking him what he had seen in the parking lot behind the complex. The five other men remained completely motionless, but he noticed how their eyes had all eerily zeroed in on him as the questioning began. He felt as if they were reading his mind. Jim was honest about what he had seen, but decided to play dumb, saying that the men he witnessed were obviously suffering from some sort of muscular disorder, and that this building must have been a research center for such conditions. Seemingly satisfied with this response, the man stepped aside and told him he was free to go. He was shown to reception, and as the man opened the main door to let him out, he said in a very matter-of-fact way, "You'll never come back here." 2 days later, Jim was inexplicably made redundant from his job. In the years since this experience, he has tried to make sense of what happened. Whilst it's a possibility that those men were indeed suffering from some sort of muscular dystrophy, and that his subsequent interrogation was nothing more than a wild prank to scare him, he can't help but feel that there was something completely abnormal about the whole situation. In his story, he described the men he saw in that room as resembling mannequins, but he has since come to the realization that they in fact reminded him of something else. It's difficult for him to comprehend, but he is now certain beyond a shadow of a doubt that what he was looking at were five corpses. In various fringe accounts regarding men in black, many people who have encountered them at length have stated how intelligences beyond our own use reanimated bodies of the dead in order to blend in. Regardless of how sensational these three stories may seem, the people who shared them believe implicitly in what they experienced. Whilst it's true that these encounters may be explained away by tiredness or the clever pranks of adept tricksters, there is always the possibility that there was something out of the ordinary taking place. In short, whether you believe these stories or not will depend on your own experiences out on the road. Drive safely.
Thank you again to our friends over at, excuse me, Bedtime Stories. The telephone seems to be a popular device to high strangeness. I've heard reports of conversations with the dead to correspondences with life forms from another time or even other dimensions. Telemarketing tactics aside, there are quite a few reports of these creepy calls, which might suggest that something out there is attempting to use our telecommunication system to make contact with us. In 1993, Geary was an Air Force captain assigned to medical pharmacy work in San Antonio, Texas. In February of the same year, he planned an unannounced surprise trip to visit his friends and family in Long Island, New York. Even though he didn't tell anybody about his trip prior to the departure, it seems that someone or something already knew. At his parents' house in New York, Geary placed a call to his longtime friend Mike. But Mike relayed how he had already spoken with Geary by phone the day before, describing how Geary had just flown in through LaGuardia Airport. Although with the impression that he was coming down with a cold, even though Geary was perfectly healthy at the time. As a result, Mike decided not to hang out with him, which left Geary quite confused. As the two of them conversed, another call came in through call waiting. With his parents still present in the room, Geary picked up the other line and in a deep, mechanical voice, greeted him with some bizarre dialogue. Instinctively, for whatever reason, Geary pressed the record button of the nearby answering machine in an attempt to document it. Here is the recording of the call he received that night.
Yes. I'll tell you who it is.
Hello?
Yeah. Do you want to speak to him?
Is Gary's son Frank there?
Yeah, who's this? Steven, are you playing games with me or what? Huh? Steven, if you're playing games, I'm going to kick your ass.
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
Huh?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Yeah, this is you, Steven, you idiot. You're pissing me off. Jerk. I'm going to get you on. Let's see what it says. Review. One new call out of area. Is Steven out of the area?
Are you going to be back from Texas?
Wait, say that again?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Wait, hold on. Is Steven out of the calling area or what?
Oh,
I know. What do you mean you don't know? He's in Queens. I don't know who the fuck.
Hello?
Hello?
Is Gary's son Frank there?
Who is this? That looks like a robot.
So hello?
How long are you going to be back from Texas?
What was that again, sir?
Being impersonated by the other voice.
No, be quiet, Alf, huh? Sorry, would you see that again? Hello? Being impersonated by what voice?
Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Is Gary's son Frank there?
Yeah, hold on a second. Yeah, what is your question? I'll answer it.
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
How long?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Right. When am I coming back? Is that your question? Okay, there was a break. Hold on. You want to know when I'm coming back to Texas? Oh, is that your question?
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
How long am I going to be back from Texas? That question doesn't make any sense.
By the other voice.
Okay. I'll be coming back eventually. I can't tell you when. You should know that question, the answer to the question, because you seem to know more about me than I do. You know what I'm saying?
Are you an intergalactic person?
Are you a space alien?
Sounds like you hung up.
I can't believe this.
He hung up, Gary.
See if he comes back.
All right, I'll hang up.
So that was the first call. Now, Gary has two brothers. Stephen is 1 year older and Brian is 5 years younger. At the moment he received the first call, Gary thought it was Stephen playing a prank on him. Stephen was not known to be a prankster, yet there was a separate strange occurrence which happened to involve both Stephen and Gary a few years prior to the strange phone call. While on a route to a wedding, also in Long Island, Stephen saw Gary drive up alongside him, make some weird faces to get his attention, and then just simply drove off. Even though Gary was in Long Island at the time, he didn't have a car to drive, let alone to make a model, he was apparently spotted in, the same exact one that had been parked at Gary's residence in San Antonio. Let's return to the night of the strange phone call in 1993, a few minutes after the first phone call came in. The phone rang a second time, and Gary pressed the record button soon after he recognized the same eerie voice.
What is your question? Yes, speaking. Yes. Can I answer any questions for you?
Are you back from Texas?
I'm not back yet, no.
How long are you going to be back from Texas?
Let me answer. First, you tell me, where are you calling from? Yeah, why don't you tell me where you're calling from?
Who is this?
What do you mean, who is this? You should know who it is. It's me, Gary. Let me ask you this question. Where are you calling from? Okay, I'll be back. Excuse me? I can't hear too well. Yeah, it is a full moon out. That's true.
Okay, so first of all, this happened in early February of 1993 at 2300 hours. So, 11 o'clock. Another one apparently came on the 8th at 11:38 p.m. Here's the link if you want to listen to the rest of the phone call. A lot of it was somewhat quiet, so it was difficult to hear. Is Gary Sub-Brink there? It just sounds very, very hokey, hokey, hokey pokey. Very, very hokey, hokey pokey. And I don't mean to call hokey, hokey pokey a thing and everything, but it just seems very, very, very hokey-pokey. I mean, I've received calls from people that I had no idea who they were and then realized that, when you have Star 6-9, you know who calls you. And all these calls stopped when people had a caller ID. And, yeah, I know there was caller ID. It came in as out of area, but you could have simply blocked your phone call and, again. I'm not saying it's B as in B, S as in S, but it's pretty darn close. I promise kids next week, because we didn't get to it today because I started rambling on about a morning show prep and all that stuff. We will get to the Ape Canyon Bigfoot attack, as well as, do I want to do the Versalis time slip? I mean, I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about on Thursday the hidden city of Death Valley, Legends of America. Did we talk about the mysterious Mojave Desert? Did we talk about that last week? Why is this on my notes? Did we talk about this last week? I think we already talked about the mysterious Mojave Desert. I'm sorry. I think we already talked about that. Yeah. So Thursday, Legends of America, the Ape Canyon Bigfoot attack. We'll discuss that. The Versalis time trip, time slip, okay. The mysterious disappearance of Kenny Veach. Okay, I think we'll do that on the 12th. A lot can happen between now and then. I could get killed. I could have a black-eyed child come into my house and just attack me, which I'm hoping doesn't happen. But if it does, kids, it's been an exciting time. And if I am killed by a black-eyed child, I'd like you to know that I've enjoyed my time on Revolution Radio. I don't know. So there you go. This, that, and the other heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, located at freedomslips.com. Common spelling in your favorite internet browser. Head over to our website, please. We are 100% listener supported. All donations go to support this AM internet workhorse. It's not even AM or FM, I'm sorry, but we are an internet workhorse. Two ways to support us: click on the store tab. You'll see a lot of items designed by our own Thomas. You probably know him as a mad painter. Right now we have a 15% off sale with the code at the store tab at freedomslips.com. Also donations. Become a Patreon, the donor box. Direct payment, North America only, por favor. We do have some cryptocurrency options, or you can write a check and send it in the mail. One way to support is free of charge. Join the chat room, or click on the schedule and host your own program. I will stay safe, Pac. I will stay safe. Pac, you and I need to do a show one evening, because I think you would be a great addition to the nonsense that occurs here. Not saying that you're full of nonsense, but I know I'm full of nonsense. I still need you to provide me documentation somehow when Politis was in Australia, because he claimed he was there. He claimed he was there doing some double top secret searching about a guy who disappeared, but I think we found out on this program that he was involved in some shady dealings with some drug dealers and was probably under the influence of a lot of cocaine and basically ran through the bush off the edge of a cliff and died. Killed him dead. Up next on the Big Studio B, beginning at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, it's a Tipping Point with Scott McKay, followed by The Right Stuff with Robert Morningstar, over on Studio A, beginning in roughly 4 to 6 minutes, Monday evening. Studio B, 8 p.m. It's The Fenton Perspective with Lorian Fenton, followed by Yours Truly, A Mad Painter with Open Canvas. That begins at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. There's the top of the music, folks. Have yourself a fabulous Monday evening. We'll talk with you on Thursday, in the words of Katie Couric. Good night, y'all.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.